Live from New York, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming from our studios in New York City, and I welcome you. Today, the latest on health and healing, we're going to talk about how short naps, 10 to 15 minutes, can boost your memory, University of California. A landmark study shows how nature kills post-traumatic stress disorder in combat veterans, University of California, Berkeley. How turmeric, that wonderful yellow spice, is good for cancer, and that's from University of Leicester. And 15 minutes of daily exercise can actually make a difference in older adults in their overall health, University Hospital in France. Today I've set time aside to deal with a few other issues. I will be addressing Bernie Sanders meeting with the president, what he said about it, and then what the newspaper is reporting that he said, and what this really means. Then today you'll hear from Russell Brand, the British comedian, but he also, Russell has some very important insights that I think we could appreciate. A short segment. But the majority of our program today would be a part of something we're adding. We're adding in-depth understanding of the larger context of issues. Today's larger context is why the people of Great Britain should vote to exit the European Union. Now, right now, it's very close. Here's why this is important. Because I believe that Greece should exit, Italy should exit, France should exit, Ireland should exit, and Portugal should exit. But it's also possible that if Great Britain exits, that a lot of others will follow suit. Why? When we've been told how wonderful the European Union is, the euro, the single currency, because it was always planned to be a way of having greater economic and political control over Europe, which is the largest economy in the world. It dwarfs the American economy, the Chinese economy. Even though America is number one and China is number two, Japan's number three, in total number of population and total amount of goods purchased, European Union comes first. So it's all corrupt. And if you've listened to Danny Sheehan on the program about the Wealth Masters that we did, you understand that they've been planning this for decades. And it means you have your rights taken away. As you'll find out today, right now there are communities all over England who think that what their local town councils and mayors and city councils want is what's done. Wrong. They have no power. They have no rule of law. All that's done in Brussels by unelected people who cannot be taken out of office. You have a parliament, a European governing body that has no power. Why? Because the people who are unelected cannot be fired, make all the rules. It's a massive fraud. So for all of our listeners in England and France and all the other countries in Ireland, we have a lot of people in Europe listening to this. I see the numbers. Use this information today. For all the Americans who thought, well, what do I care about the European Union? What do I care about a vote if they're staying in or out? It doesn't mean anything to me. It does. Because the Trans-Pacific Partnership, NAFTA, GATT, the World Trade Organizations, they're all connected. And if we pass the Trans-Pacific Partnership, we will virtually be in the same state politically and with rules and regulations that the European Union has all these other nations trapped in. So we'll show you what's wrong with the European Union. We'll show you the impact it's had on Great Britain. We'll take you behind the scenes. And the people you're hearing are leading professors, leading economists, leading journalists, investigative reporters, some of the brightest men and women in Great Britain, you're going to hear today in depth. So this is a part of this, looking at the larger picture. Let me give you an example. On Saturday, a person came up to me who's in our new health support group, and the person said, "Are you just going to talk about health?" And I said, "No, I'm going to talk about everything that manifests as health, but it's going to be far broader." "Well, I was just interested in nutrition." "Then this isn't for you." "Why not?" "Okay, let's just say that you wanted to eat healthy. But what if I'm suggesting that you not eat genetically engineered foods, and you think, well, what difference does it make? What makes a big difference? Having glyphosate in your body, do you want a chemical poison in your body that can disrupt your hormones, that could cause breast cancer? Is that what you want? Or do you want something locally grown that's organic?" That's political. Deciding to buy food that is local, that has a low carbon footprint, that wasn't grown 5,000 miles away or 20,000 miles away in South Africa and shipped in here in the middle of the winter, having locally grown, seasonally grown, hydroponically grown, you're supporting not just your health, you're supporting a movement. When you stop buying out of the big box stores, when you stop buying out of Walmart or Trader Joe's or the others, and you come back to a local food cooperative, to a farmer's market, to a health food store, or to a local farmer's buying club directly, that's just not about your health. But you wouldn't want to know any of that. You just want to know, do I eat lettuce? Do I eat carrots? What do I eat? I'm not that person. There are plenty of dietitians you can go to who will tell you that. I want you to know, if you want to give up meat, you want organic meat. I'm saying give up all meat. Why? Because I'm going to tell you what that animal goes through. Do you think the media is going to share that with you? Do you think the media, the doctors, and the nutritionists at the national level are going to tell you what's wrong with meat, what's wrong with bologna, what's wrong with salami, what's wrong with cheese and dairy? And no, they're not. If you think you can be healthy just eating healthy foods, you are delusional. It's not possible. Not humanly possible. You better grow up at some point, pull back from this micro focus, and look at the larger picture that everything is connected. Do you at all care about the fact that those who are advocating healthy living, meditation, exercise, juicing, fasting, raw food, do you realize now they're all on watch lists? Do you care? Do you care that those who are advocating freedom are now considered an enemy of the state? Every one of their emails are read, their phones are monitored. Wherever they show up, wherever they lecture, someone's there from a Homeland Security, listening, watching, recording. I didn't know that. You see, you're not willing to look at the larger picture. Do you care about the water you drink, that there's fluoride in it and shouldn't be in there? It doesn't prevent tooth decay, causes disease. Do you care about the sugar your kid's getting? Do you care about being diagnosed with bipolar when there is no brain chemical imbalance study ever in history? Do you care about there is no such thing as a chemical imbalance in the brain? It doesn't exist. So how could you be healthy if in a mood, or your kid's in a mood, you send your kid off to a psychiatrist, now the kid's on drugs, now the kid commits suicide? Do you hold any responsibility for your kid dying because you didn't look for the truth, you trusted? You see, it gets a lot more complicated when you want to know the truth of something. If you just want straight indoctrination, I'm the wrong person to be around. You're not going to like what I have to say, because I'm not going to temper or in any way deconstruct the larger truth to satisfy individual needs. That's why this new series is so important. Americans are just, they're dumbing down at a level that I have never seen in my existence, especially younger people. So be a little patient, learn the truth, even if it doesn't, means that you're not getting some instant gratification for something that's not going to do you any good in any case. Know the truth of what's happening globally. Know the truth of what's happening locally. Know the truth of what's happening politically, economically, socially, culturally. Know the truth of these things. Then you're not going to be a puppet they're going to use or condition. And that's why this is so important. Let's begin. Naps. Naps are important for adults, for all ages. You don't have to have a long nap. And if you rest on your back, and if you put a little headrest, something will cradle the back of the skull, it's even better. and then just put a nice soft material across your eyes, something that will darken out the light, and just allow yourself just to be at ease. Now, according to the University of California, Riverside, a team of sleep researchers led by psychology professor Sarah Metnick found that the autonomic nervous system, which is responsible for controlled bodily functions not consciously directed, such as breathing and heartbeat and digestive processes that are going to happen 24/7, but that plays a role in promoting memory improvement, the process of converting information from short-term to long-term memory during sleep. It's a groundbreaking study. It was published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science. Quote, sleep has been shown to facilitate the transformation of recent experiences into long-term stable memories. So quite simply, by taking a nap each day, you actually enhance your capacity for memory. You boost your memory. You have a better memory, more accurate memory. How long? 10 to 15 minutes. Not long at all. Also, we have a lot of people suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. In fact, in the very near future, probably in the next 6 weeks, I'll be taking a road trip. And anyone in the area who wants to join me can see what it's like when I go back to refilm a group of homeless veterans down near Titusville, Florida. And I'm going to see how they're doing based upon when I last filmed them a year and a half ago. And then before that, it was a year ago. Before that, all of them suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder. Every single one. And they were homeless. They couldn't get jobs because when you're a homeless vet, it's very hard to get a job. People are just biased. They don't want to hire you, thinking that somehow you're going to go off the deep end and or not be reliable. And that's not true. I met very responsible people who all had crafts and skills. So they're relegated to living in the shadows of life. Their whole day is sitting around talking with other vets. They all have post-traumatic stress. But when they go to the beach in the morning, most of them do, to take a shower, and where you get out of the water as a swimmer, but they're very clever about it. They shave and they bathe and they use the bathroom at those facilities, but they act like they're just a normal person going to the beach, because if anyone sees that they're a homeless vet going there, they could get fined doing the same identical thing that someone using the beach would do. But the fact that they've been designated a vet, that means they get fined. If they stop and rest in a veteran's park, they can be arrested, given a $500 fine. I interview people who were reading a book. One guy was reading a book in a veteran's park, and he was given a ticket and told to move on. So we have an extraordinary problem with a million homeless vets. A million we're at now. And so I'm going to go back and I'm going to implement a new program. I'm going to take 12 individuals, as I mentioned a couple of years ago, because when I tell you I'm going to do something, I do it. I said I'm going to build a community environment where vets and their families can come together, get holistic help, holistic humanistic counseling, trade in job training, eat organic food, have a nice, beautiful place to live. I built it all. It's done. And now I'm going to select the vets to be a part of it and hopefully find a master sergeant down there who was helping vets. I hope he's still there because he's a terrific guy. And I think it's important you see, personally see, what it's like to be in someone else's shoes. Look at life through their experience each day, what you have to go through, what they're going through. And then I think you'll appreciate why we need an entirely different mindset and a commitment to help our vets. I do not support any of the military activities, but I support them because they're human beings and they need a chance. Here's the latest study and why I believe they should be in nature. We should build centers, rehabilitation centers, based upon the model that I've created, which can be done in every community in America, where the vet is in nature. That's the key. Get them out of the cities, get them in nature. Quote, post-traumatic stress disorder wreaks havoc on war veterans, survivors of various forms of abuse, accident or disaster witnesses, or victims, and many more. But the pharmaceuticals dispensed for treatment can worsen the problem. Mind you, this I'm quoting exactly University of California, Berkeley. Selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, such as Prozac, Celexa, Zoloft, and Paxil, comprise the most frequently prescribed class of antidepressants, but bear the burden of responsibility for an epidemic of suicide in the United States. By the way, that's now up to 23 a day, every 24 hours, every week, every year, for over 13 years. So it's thousands upon thousands of people have taken their own lives. And it says, fortunately, viable, infinitely safer, more effective alternatives abound, all provided by nature. In fact, nature itself shows encouraging results in the treatment of post-traumatic stress disorder. According to the findings of this multi-year research study, and researchers gathered dozens of University of California, Berkeley student veterans whose psychological and physiological response to the osmosis of big nature is being studied. And what they found is it felt a lot better. People were able to improve, their moods improved, their emotional well-being improved, and it wasn't from drugs. It was from being in nature. So imagine all of our state parks, our national parks. Imagine being able to hire people in the local communities at a living wage to help build these and help people work there. Think of all the different gardening. You could have food. They could actually create a food that enough for not only for themselves, but hydroponically, you can grow 12 months a year enough to feed whole communities. It will be a way of giving back. So the homeless vets not only are living in a beautiful environment, all natural, powered by solar or hydro power or by geothermal or the new generation of wind turbines that don't kill all the birds and don't cause the sound pollution that they're out now and being used. But they could also grow enough to give to local food banks, which are hard-pressed for food. And what you almost never see at these food banks are healthy fruits and vegetables, and certainly not organic. And when I was in one food bank, I'm looking at the cans, and they're all expired. The guy said, what can I do? That's all I can get. And the food itself was very unhealthy. And the master sergeant says, this is all that we can get. And he said, I wished it was healthy. Well, there are some that are getting healthy because I know I'm helping them. So I know they're getting healthy food. But imagine if we had 1,000 centers around the United States helping vets and their families. And then as an offshoot, they can grow produce to give to local community food banks and churches, mosques, synagogues, to help the poor in their congregations. It's doable. And I'm going to do that starting in 6 weeks because I don't have to. Took 2.5 years to get it all done, but it's done. But now this other study is showing just putting a vet in nature helps them, just that. And that's important. One of the things that the homeless vets in Florida told me was a lot of them came from other climates up north. They said in the wintertime, you could freeze to death outside. The shelters are all full, so you sleep wherever you can. When someone goes into one of the bank branches to draw money out at night, you go in there and you just sit, and because it's warmer in there. And I don't think we appreciate what they go through just to survive each day. And they've been forgotten. And yet we put all the money into the military-industrial complex, which is completely non-productive and wasted and corrupt, instead of putting it into helping these vets recover. So, now another study is on curcumin. And they have a study that they did. They found, quote, curcumin found in turmeric specifically addresses the choroid formation, a cell configuration that indicates stem cell-driven cancer progression. It also downregulates cancer cell stem-associated markers. And these are all indications that curcumin, cures, C-U-R, cumin, C-U-M-I-N, can target the cancer stem cells at the root of malignancy. The researchers even attest that curcumin outperformed the combination of chemotherapy. How about that? Curcumin outperformed chemotherapy. Quote, why turmeric may eventually rise above chemo. Chemotherapy is extremely toxic to the body, but turmeric is effective in killing cancer stem cells and also has no toxic side effects. This one huge reason why turmeric for cancer can be so desirable. And then it lists all the different major studies on curcumin and cancer, so good for that. And finally, 15 minutes of exercise, according to University Hospital in France, can help older adults live longer lives. Quote, 15 minutes of daily exercise is associated with a 22% lower risk of death and may be a reasonable target for older adults. This was in the Prevent 2016 study, and that's good. Quote, age is not an excuse not to exercise. It is well established that regular physical activity has a better overall effect on health than any medical treatment. But less than half of older adults achieve the recommended minimum of 150 minutes moderate intensity or 75 minutes vigorous exercise per week. And so it went on to talk about that if you do an intense exercise 15 minutes a day, you can add a very positive 22% lower risk of death on your side of the equation. How about that? That is good. I'm Gary Nall. We're going to take a break, come back, and we're going to have hear Russell Brand. Then we're going to go right into why people in Great Britain should vote to get out of the European Union, a completely corrupt, autocratic institution.
In America. America when Obama was elected, and it was people were in the streets, Oprah Winfrey was endorsing him, it all seemed fantastic. But the reality of Obama's presidency is his drones have killed 2,400 people over 5 years, a new type of military murder. Obama is aggressively pushing the TTIP and the TPP trade agreements that if they come to Europe will mean that corporations will be able to hold private courts that people won't know what's going on within them to make sure that nothing gets in the way of them profiteering. It's so mad and sounds so much like a subplot from Star Wars that I can't believe it's real. David Cameron supports it also.
President Obama hides behind this phony facade.
Under Obama, the richest 10% of wealthy Americans are better off, while the number of people on benefits has peaked. Despite his initial pledge, Obama has never closed Guantanamo Bay. Still open, still doing a roaring trade at Guantanamo Bay. Obama's crackdown on immigration has filled up US prisons with Hispanics, prisons that are paid for increasingly with private funding and built for profit. In America, two black people are killed by white police officers every week. Now, when you were voting for Obama, that is what you were voting for. We can now, using the magic of history, we can see that where we were going, yes, we can, change, hope, what we're voting for, dead black people, filled prisons, bombing innocent people abroad, and signing deals that give corporations literally unlimited power. There's no terrorist organisation that's as powerful as a transnational global elite. They're about to insert new laws and new legislation across the globe that make them even more powerful.
I'm confident that will happen.
Yeah, that's Russell Brand. Now, quick comment before we go to our extended commentary. Bernie to Hillary, quote, be like me. I'm quoting the article by Marisha Schultz, New York Post. Bernie Sanders will meet with Hillary Clinton today and intends to press the presumptive Democratic nominee to adopt a progressive platform of free college tuition, universal health care, tackling climate change and new taxes on Wall Street and billionaires, the Vermont senator said Sunday. Sanders signaled in two interviews that he's winding down his Democratic presidential bid, but will be urging Clinton to adopt many of his signature issues. quote, "I simply want to get a sense of what kind of platform she will be supporting," he told NBC. "And after we have that kind of discussion and after we can determine whether or not we're going to have a strong and progressive platform, I will be able to make other decisions," end quote. Well, the other decision is then encouraging his followers to join Hillary Clinton, as he will try to invoke the idea that she's agreed. Of course she's going to agree. Anyone would agree if you're going to get a guaranteed group of people as large as what your own more corporate Democrat group is. You're getting young idealists on your side. And that means you're going to win the presidency. You're going to say anything. But the problem is not Hillary Clinton. The problem is Bernie Sanders. Mr. Sanders, you said you wanted to lead a revolution. You can. You still have time. Join with Jill Stein and the Green Party. You can get on the ballot. You can get into the states. You would win because over 41% of all registered voters are independent, and you would get a lot of the progressives. Right now, Hillary's getting no progressives, as I know. Now, she may get liberals, she may get Democrats. That we expect. Blue Dog Democrats, yes. But she won't get any progressives because they know who she is, they know who her husband are, they know that they're not for our interest. And she would never follow through by changing any of the trade treaties. She would support the Trans-Pacific Partnership. It would become law under her, because she has 44 separate emails that show that she was advocating for her State Department, through her personally, to get other countries on board. She was a major cheerleader. Now she turns around because she sees a focus poll says, show that you're, and like she did with the debate with Dennis Kucinich in Cleveland, I believe it was, Cleveland or Columbus, back when she was originally running against Obama. She talked about NAFTA, would she do something? We're going to look at that, and boy, we're going to do what's good for the American public. No, she didn't look at it. Only one person on that stage said they would revoke NAFTA and get us out. That was Dennis Kucinich, the person who should have been president. And second to him would have been Ron Paul, who would have got us. But no, they got nowhere. So she's going to say yes to anything you suggest. You put a few people on the platform, like Cornel West, it won't mean anything, because these are really powerful political operatives, and they've known for a long time how to say, we're going to do this for you, we're going to do that for you, we'll pass this piece of legislation, but you let us do what we're going to do. So everything that she was before this election, she will be when she's president, and we will be completely done. So if you really are interested in the public, then do not support her. But Chris Hedges and other real progressives believe that you are a shill, that you had your moment, and that unlike Ralph Nader, and unlike Joel Stein, and unlike Rocky Anderson, you will roll over because you want to stay the good corporate Democrat, as you have been, with a few things you've done separate that are positive. Now we'll see. We'll see whether Chris is right, and he simply led everyone to believe in something that he didn't have the courage, the sacrifice, to go against. Let's see who's right. I hope that Bernie realizes that the majority of the people who supported him will not support Hillary Clinton. But we'll know very shortly. Now let's listen in. We're leading historians, economists, investigative journalists are telling us the truth about what none of us knew when it came to the European Union, including people living in Great Britain. Now you will.
You're British. This film is about you, every one of you. Something is happening in Britain which increasingly intrudes into the way you live. Traditional customs, familiar and trusted patterns of a liberal, compassionate society, the British way of doing things, all are disappearing and being replaced by a frustrating avalanche of alien regulation and bureaucracy. This is happening not in such a popular demand, but as a result of British membership of the European Union. The very character of our unique way of life is being destroyed, and there has been no public debate, consultation, or approval. The people appearing in this film are not politicians or civil servants. They don't seek your vote or your money. They only ask that for a few moments you watch and listen and then make up your own mind. Almost all you're about to hear has been hidden from you. Everything you're about to hear is the truth.
For the last 34 years, British politicians have been hiding from you the fact that they've been handing over the governance of your country to Brussels. This film shows how close they are to completing that process. In 1972, the British people were told that they were joining something called the Common Market. They were assured by Prime Minister Edward Heath that this was just a trading arrangement and involved no loss of essential national sovereignty. In this, the British nation was seriously and deliberately deceived. Today, as a result of that 1972 arrangement, British national identity, a British government, and British independence are about to be sacrificed. Britain is to disappear within a European federal state, and the British people are to be governed from Brussels by unelected foreign officials. A succession of British politicians have continued that 1972 deceit and secretly stripped Britain of self-government. Details of this whole process have been suppressed and kept from you. Most people in Britain haven't a clue as to what is happening. Christopher Booker explains why.
One of the most remarkable things about the European Union is how ignorant people are as to how it came about. A few years ago, when my colleague Richard North and I began researching the history of what is called the European Project, we were astonished to find just how distorted and inaccurate all previous accounts of this story had been. The core ideas which have inspired this project go back to the 1920s, and for the men behind it, notably the Frenchman Jean Monnet, their ultimate goal, right from the start, was to create a United States of Europe. Their aim was to place the peoples of Europe under a form of government like nothing the world had seen before, a government that was supranational. To achieve their goal, they came up with two brilliantly clever ideas. The first was that it could never be achieved overnight. It would have to be assembled piece by piece over many years without revealing its ultimate purpose. The other idea was that all the national governments of Europe should be left in place, while being gradually hollowed out from within, as they passed under ever greater control by the supranational power. Thus, what amounted to a slow-motion coup d'etat could take place without people realizing what was happening. That is why we called our story The Great Deception, because such is what the historical evidence shows it to have been. Step one in the early 1950s was Monnet's European Coal and Steel Community. He never intended this body to be anything other than the embryo of what would eventually be a government for Europe. The next step was to widen this into a European Economic Community set up by the Treaty of Rome in 1957. Again, this common market was deliberately intended to be just a cover for their true goal of complete political union. For nearly 30 years, the handing over of powers by national governments continued, the original six countries becoming 12, until in the 1980s the project was ready for its next great leap forward. This would need two new treaties, the Single European Act in 1986 and the Maastricht Treaty on European Union in 1992, followed in 1997 and 2001 by two more at Amsterdam and Nice. By now, the real aims were coming out ever more into the open, as it was agreed that this new supranational government should have its own currency, its own foreign and defence policies, its own court system and police force, all the attributes of a sovereign state. Finally, as the number of member countries rose to 25,
it was agreed that as the next great symbolic act in the story, Europe must have its own constitution. In 2005, as we know, this was rejected by the voters of France and Holland. But by now, the project is so far advanced that those behind it believe it must roll on regardless. As we finally wake up to their real aim, how much longer can the wishes of the people of Europe be ignored? Such is the battle in which today, whether we like it or not, we are all involved.
The EU Constitution Christopher Booker referred to is a major step in the final transfer of power from Westminster to Brussels. But it's more than that. It will mean imposing on the British people a continental view of freedom where nothing is allowed unless the law says so. In Britain, we are free-born from the moment of our birth, able to do anything unless the law prohibits. In the European Union, we are about to lose that. Britain already has a constitution of its own, one that has stood the test of time and been admired and copied by other countries, in particular America, whose founding fathers used the British model when drafting their own constitution. Is it so important that we retain our own constitution? What's so special about it? Here's John Bingley.
A constitution should define the relationship between the governance of a nation and its people, setting limitations on power and providing the people with safeguards that protect them by securing the means of redress and remedy. We most certainly do have a British constitution, and it does just that. Our constitution has evolved over many centuries and consists of much written law. The best known examples are the Magna Carta in 1215 and the Declaration and Bill of Rights of 1688-9. In Britain, we are governed according to the rule of law. The rules contained in our constitution define how we must be governed. Primarily, the coronation oath stipulates the rule of law as the only means of our lawful governance and places limitations on the use of executive power. Those limitations stop the divine right of kings. There ought to be no divine right of politicians either. In short, the British Constitution and the rule of law provide a framework for government by creating boundaries and constraints on the exercise of power. Dictatorial power can only come about when the ruler has both the power to make the law and to enforce it. Mussolini, Hitler and Stalin all achieved this total authority, resulting in staggering bloodshed. Our unique British Constitution prevents such unification of power taking place. Some vital principles of our Constitution are the right to jury trial, the right of habeas corpus, the presumption of innocence, the right to silence, no taxation without representation, no cruel and unusual punishments. All these principles and others are at the core of our Constitution and integral to our liberty, with a separation of powers as the safeguarding mechanism at its heart. It is entirely different from the continental system of administration and the proposed EU constitution, where nothing is allowed unless the law permits. Our ancient constitution determines that the duty of our politicians is to maintain our liberty. Liberty is the norm in Britain and is only constrained by the law. We British are free to do anything unless the law prohibits. The British Constitution has prevented the worst excesses of tyranny or despotism for centuries. Why should we wish to exchange this for a system which supports the unelected, the irremovable, and the unaccountable? The imposition of the EU Constitution will mean the end of the British Constitution, and along with it will go all the protections we have enjoyed for centuries, including our right and our children's right of self-determination.
In addition to bringing about the end of our unique British form of freedom, the EU Constitution transfers significant political power to Brussels. This, together with the combined losses brought about by the five treaties, means that the British people will no longer be free to govern themselves. We are close to the end game. But the EU Constitution, we were informed, could only be implemented if all 25 countries ratified it. Christopher Booker has been examining whether or not that condition has been observed and what the EU Constitution really means.
It was in the late 1990s that the political leaders of the European Union began to talk about the need to give Europe a constitution. For decades, they had been proceeding with their plan to assemble a supranational government for Europe by stealth. But they had got so far, they now felt, that concealment was no longer necessary. If the United States had a constitution, so should the new United States of Europe. In 2002, delegates from 25 countries met for 15 months in Brussels to draft the new constitution, very much guided by their chairman, Giscard d'Estaing, the former president of France. It then took their governments another year to agree on the final text, this huge document here. The original American Constitution had just 7 articles. This Constitution for Europe contains 448, which originally covered 800 pages. In some ways, this Constitution is just another treaty because it incorporates all the earlier treaties, but it makes the intention to set up a European government much more obvious than ever before. It gives the European Union, the Union as they now call it, pretty well all the attributes of a fully fledged state, with its own flag, its own currency, its own foreign and defence policies, its own courts and legal officers, its own federal police force. It gives the Union, for the first time, its own legal personality, with the right to behave on the international stage just like any sovereign government. It recognises for the first time in a treaty the principle that the laws of the Union are superior in every respect to those made by national parliaments and courts. It marks a further massive handing over of powers from national governments to the central government in Brussels. It greatly extends the areas of life where Brussels has the power to dictate policies and laws. It also reduces, almost to vanishing point, the right of national governments to veto laws which they do not consider in their country's interests. It includes all the 54 articles of the so-called Charter of Fundamental Rights, the document which we were told by a British minister would have no more legal significance than a copy of the Sun newspaper or the Beano. What this document confirms, in short, is the desire to set up a supranational government which is not elected and which the peoples of Europe cannot call to account or dismiss. It marks the transformation of Europe, in effect, into a one-party state. Yet this is what the governments of Europe agreed to in our name in 2004. Only in 2005, when it was rejected by the voters of France and Holland, did the plan to impose this constitution on us all at last run into a mighty obstacle. For the moment, it has been put on ice. But there are plenty of people at the top in Europe who are looking for ways to bring it back onto the agenda. Meanwhile, they are already pushing ahead with many of its contents, from a European space programme to a common defence policy, just as if their constitution was already legally in force. They are not going to give up.
The EU constitution sweeps up those few areas of governmental power that still, just about, remain British. But what about our economy? Whoever controls the currency controls the country. And at the moment, we still have our own currency, the pound sterling. Signing up to the EU constitution would undoubtedly increase the pressure on Britain to enter the single currency. This would mean Britain's economy being controlled by the foreign bankers of the European Central Bank in Frankfurt. Ian Milne has been looking at EU economics.
There's a huge misconception that the EU political economic model represents the future. Big mistake. Let me explain. The EU model is copied nowhere in the developed world. The relatively few customs unions that do exist are in poor African and Latin American countries, former Soviet satellites, and some of the Gulf states. But outside Europe, no major industrial trading nation, not the USA, not Japan, not South Korea, not Singapore, not Australia, not Chile, has chosen to conduct its trade via an EU-type customs union and single market. Neither, and here's the killer fact, have tomorrow's economic giants, China and India. All have chosen user-friendly, light-touch, government-to-government arrangements. That's the future, trade-wise. The claim that the UK needs the EU for its trade and jobs is an empty one. Over 90% of the UK economy is not involved in exporting to the EU. The USA, not in the EU, sells more to the EU than the UK does, without paying a penny to Brussels or imposing 1 ounce of EU regulation on the US economy. The UK has a huge and growing deficit on its trade with continental Europe, and the cost of UK membership of the EU massively outweighs the benefit. British access to the 6% of the world's population living in the EU costs us a fortune. The Treasury hands over £250 million of our taxes to Brussels every single week. British access to the other 94% of the world's population outside the EU is free. The fact is, the EU is the past, invented in the 1950s to meet the failures of the 1930s. But in tomorrow's world, it'll soon be an irrelevance, overshadowed by the USA, China and India, all of which, as it happens, conduct their business in English. Those are the countries we have to be free to engage with, as equals, to build a better world in the 21st century. It's time this country got out and embraced the future.
So our political power has been handed away, our constitutional power is planned to go, and our economic power is being seriously threatened. All this was planned and must happen if the EU is to control us completely. But that isn't enough. Everything that is British must go, and that's where local government plays its part in dismantling the British state. Part of the political takeover is the hollowing out process Christopher Booker spoke of earlier, and the pretense that our Parliament still governs Britain, whilst in reality it is merely the puppet of Brussels. Eventually, Westminster will cease to exist, and 12 regional governments, answerable to Brussels, will take over. This breakup of Britain has been investigated by Lindsay Jenkins.
For generations, we in the United Kingdom have enjoyed democratic local government. We've elected councillors for our town or county councils. Many of us have volunteered to be parish councillors, unpaid, to do our bit for the village. But within a year or two, it will all be gone. Most of it has gone already. The Treaty of Rome was the death knell for democratic government. Today, county, borough, and parish councils are all giving way to regions, to sub-regions, and sub-sub-regions, the European Union's system of local government. But it's taken time to destroy what was British and replace it with the European model. John Major began the rot with government offices in the regions, new divisions, never before known in this country. But when Tony Blair won that landslide victory in 1997, the destruction accelerated. London, Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland now have their own elected assemblies. The one in Edinburgh is grandly called a parliament. They may think they have a large measure of independence and freedom, but each is just a region in the European Union. And what about the rest of England? That's divided into 8 regions, the South West, the South East, the East Midlands and so on, but with appointed assemblies. When people in the North East gave a resounding thumbs down to an elected assembly, the appointed assembly just carried on regardless. But assemblies don't matter. Elected or not, they're just wallpaper. One assembly member told me that he got his massive pile of papers just days before a meeting, and he had no real idea of what was going on. Only the few who drive this process know. They're the assembly officers, the permanent staff, confident, powerful, professional. They're the real power brokers. It's a charade of democracy. The new regions are getting more and more power. Planning. How we can use our land, British land, has already been removed from elected local and county councils and is directed from Brussels. Every region's plans now have to fit into the Brussels plan. Soon it will be the turn of the police and their new super regional forces. Will they answer to the European Union's police force, Europol, in The Hague? Soon London will be just a regional capital and not a focus of the nation state, because there won't be a nation state, just a collection of European regions. Britain will have disappeared.
As you have seen, since 1972, the balkanization of Britain into 12 EU provinces has continued apace, so that today the process of deconstructing Britain is almost complete. And there is nothing our politicians seem willing to do about it, albeit that it is in defiance of our own constitution. So, is this the end of Britain and the right of the British to govern themselves? Is EU membership, as some would have you believe, inevitable? And is there an alternative to being part of a European federal state? Well, here are two views of the future from two very different standpoints. First, Ian Milne again.
The story of the next 50 years is going to be the rise and rise of the world outside the EU, where the other 94% of the population of the planet lives. In that vibrant, growing 94%, the independent, self-governing nation is the rule, not the exception. Our English-speaking cousins in America, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, Singapore are proud to be self-governing nations. The world's second biggest economy, Japan, is proud to be a self-governing nation. So are those coming superpowers, China and India. For all these countries, big and small, the idea of surrendering the power to govern themselves, as Britain has done, to a supranational bureaucracy, and a corrupt one at that, is literally incomprehensible. We're the third biggest trading nation in the world, ahead of Japan, and the fifth biggest economy in the world. We're the headquarters of the Commonwealth, that voluntary association of English-speaking, self-governing nations, with members on six continents and almost a third of global population. So the claim that we'd be isolated outside the EU is pure, unadulterated nonsense. Just think of the benefits of reclaiming our independence by leaving the EU and joining that growing 94% of the world. First, trade. We already do 50% more of our trade outside the EU than with the EU. And our exports outside the EU are growing faster than our exports to the EU. We'd focus on the Asia-Pacific region, which is currently growing five times as fast as the EU. We'd resume our seat and vote at the World Trade Organization. We'd resume our trading alliances with our friends in the Commonwealth. And we'd strike up new ones with the Asian Tigers. Not least, free of the immoral EU Common Agricultural Policy, we'd help the poorest nations in the world by offering them free access to our own markets. Second, defence. It's NATO that's kept the peace in Europe, not the EU. Free of the EU, we'd be able once again to refocus our efforts on NATO, not as at present on the European army that the French and Germans are determined to foist on us. Third, we save huge amounts of our own taxpayers' money. No longer will we hand over £13 billion a year to the EU, a sum that would buy us a dozen new hospitals or four new aircraft carriers every year. And, as the Chancellor has admitted, we'd save an awful lot more by throwing off the burden of regulation we don't need and by being outside the ruinous Common Agricultural Policy. But most important of all, we'd get our democracy back. That's what getting back sovereignty means. Our own Westminster MPs would once again have the sole power to run our government, a power they've now abandoned to the EU. And we, the citizens, through our right to hire and fire them, would get back control of our own government. After withdrawal, what happens? We continue as members of the United Nations, of NATO, of the Commonwealth, of the World Bank, and so on. We make it clear to the rest of the EU that they are our friends and allies. We keep free trade and free movement of capital with the rest of the EU because they'll be desperate to keep on sending us BMWs and Renaults and Camembert cheese. We're their biggest single customer worldwide. They sell us far more than we sell them. which means that more of their jobs depend on trade with us than on the other way round. Finally, how do we get out? It's simpler than you'd think. First, we get the support of the British people in a referendum, and then we repeal the 1972 European Communities Act, by which we joined the then.
There you've heard some of the most reasoned, measured, but honest reasons why you should vote exit the European Union. On some upcoming programs, I will have experts on to talk about, including Danny Sheehan, about who the people were behind the European Union, this single currency, this single world government. And mind you, if you heard it many times from each of these experts, no way of electing them, no way of replacing them. They're there for as long as they choose to be. And you don't have any input in the laws. You simply have to obey or be punished. That's not democracy. So my hope is that the thousands upon thousands listening now in Europe will take this message and go forward. It's coming up next week. Vote, get out of the European Union, and reestablish real democracy. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more on our next program. Have a nice day, everyone.